have a quorum present, but we are doing an overview, and we're very excited that the new Secretary of State, Steve Simon, is here to talk with us about some of his priorities and plans for the upcoming session. Please come to the table, Mr. Secretary, and I'm just curious, is this your first time testifying before a committee in which you have not been a legislator?
Who set that up?
You guys raised that up.
Madam Chair and members, I testified this morning before the comparable committee in the House.
Oh, well.
But this is the first Senate committee.
Great. We're
and thanks for having me, Madam Chair and members. I really appreciate it. It's an honor to be here, both because I'm new to this office and to these duties, and because, of course, I served for 10 years in the legislature in the other body. I was tempted to be defensive about having come from the other body, except that I noticed that 6 out of the 9 of you on this committee also came from the other body.
That's correct.
So
no,
I don't feel
defensive.
So bad. Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity. I think today, as I understood it, I would just go over a little bit of the elections portion of this office's jurisdiction and duties. Obviously, there are others. But they don't pertain particularly to this committee. I'm happy to answer questions about them, but I thought I'd focus on the elections portion and then talk a little bit, a little off script in the sense that there's no PowerPoint, about some priorities and issues that we at least wanted to bring to your attention that this office will be focusing on this year. There will be bills later. This isn't a bill hearing, I understand, but just to flag general concepts as well. I hope that I will avoid the sin of PowerPoint, Madam Chair, which is to simply read what's before you. I don't really want to do that. I want to add a little bit of value to the slides that you have. Yeah.
Judiciary is late. They just got out. So.
Thank you for joining us.
What's that?
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, all right. Well, I'm not on judiciary, but I thought I'd...
They'll be coming, I'm sure.
They're coming, yeah. I just checked on them.
And Madam Chair and members, before I go any further, though, what I wanted to do before I got into the heart of this is introduce you, or as the case may be, reintroduce you to people who are senior staff in the audience who you'll be seeing a lot of, I hope. Have them introduce themselves, and I know they'll tell you what I will tell you, which is that all three of us want to be as open and as accessible to all of you, members and staff, as possible. So we hope that you'll... take us up on our invitation anytime to call, to stop by the office on the first floor of the state office building and discuss with us your concerns, your ideas, your criticisms, whatever it may be. But I'll have them introduce themselves.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Kaner-Roth, and I'm the new Deputy Secretary of State. I'll be working with the Secretary in the office, as well as Julie, on legislative matters, external affairs, and other issues to the office. Thanks for having us.
I'm Julie Strother. I do government relations for the office. So if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out. But thank you for having us.
With that, Madam Chair and members, to the presentation, just wanted to start out a little bit by talking about the Secretary of State's duties when it comes to elections. I think one thing that many of you know is there is somewhat of a misconception among some members of the public that the Secretary of State's office runs the Minnesota election system. That's really not the whole truth. The whole truth is that it's really a partnership between the Secretary of State's office, but more importantly, those on the front lines at the county level and at the local level. It's those county auditors and county auditor treasurers and other elections administrators who really do the bulk of the frontline work. They're the ones who recruit and train the election judges. They're the ones who purchase and maintain and test the equipment. They're the ones who fully administer the elections on a week-in, week-out, election-by-election basis. And so it's to them that we owe a great debt in terms of how copied and envied we are throughout the country in terms of our election system. So this slide, again, I don't want to just read from it, but as you can see, there are many duties of support that the Secretary of State's office gives to those who are really on the front lines, everything from certifying county election administrators to operating the SVRS, or statewide voter registration system, which has within it a lot of interfaces with other portions of state government and other portions of government, even on the federal level as well. And so those database and sort of filtering and screening duties are very important. The county auditor, or sometimes they go by auditor treasurer, as some of you know, they're the ones who, as I say, really do a lot of the frontline work. They are the ones who deal with the equipment. They're the ones who deal with data in the SVRS on things like deaths, felony convictions, et cetera. They're the ones who can individually craft on a county-by-county basis the look and feel of their ballots, as long as they meet certain guidelines and requirements. They also purchase and maintain the supplies. They do all manner of things to the voting equipment, including testing, do all the absentee balloting, of course, and then, of course, tally and compile results that are fed into the statewide system, which makes for our long and sometimes entertaining election nights. So it really is the county auditors or auditor treasurers that are really the spine of the system. They're the ones who do a lot of the hard work and sort of the unheralded work many of the time. I want to flag, though, a couple of issues, though, in my conversations with many at the local level, at the county level, particularly, but not only, but particularly in greater Minnesota, issues that, in general, I think are going to come before this committee, come before the legislature, and that all policymakers will have to address. This is not in the PowerPoint at this point, but I think they're important ones. Number one has to do with election equipment. Many of you are familiar with the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, which was passed by Congress in the aftermath of the Bush versus Gore presidential election. Now, wherever any of us were on Bush versus Gore on the merits, everyone in Congress seemed to agree when they passed the Help America Vote Act that Florida, frankly, had been a mess. And a mess because there were so many uneven standards, and you had the butterfly ballots and all sorts of sort of embarrassments, I think. And everyone agreed that that was the case. We could do better. And so Congress passed HAVA, and as part of that was money directed at local units of government so that they could purchase election equipment, streamline their operations, bring them into the 21st century more fully. Well, that money, which was really a one-time stream of money, has now dried up. There is no more HAVA money. And what that means is that the election equipment that so many local jurisdictions purchase with the HAVA money will soon be run its course, and that election equipment will reach the end of its useful life, typically 10 to 15 years, depending on the machine. But 10 to 15 years from, let's say, somewhere in the 2003 to 2009 range, let's say, when a lot of this equipment was purchased, you can do the math and see that maybe not now, but by 2016, 2018, certainly 2020, the bill is going to come due, and a lot of counties are going to get hit with a one-time replacement cost that is not insignificant. These machines, at least the current version, cost about $5,000 or $6,000 a pop. I don't even know what the next generation will cost, but even currently $5,000 or $6,000, and even small counties that have told me, well, we only have 20-something or 30-something polling places in the entire county, you can do the math, times $5,000 or $6,000, even though it's only a once-in-a-decade-and-a-half expense, it's a big expense. And so one thing that's been floated in the past, which I think I hope that you'll consider and others will, if not this year, then soon, is the idea of maybe a dedicated fund of some kind where counties could draw on some equitable basis that the legislature would determine, could draw on that money for that once a decade, once every decade and a half expense. Some have floated the idea of a 50-cent or some surcharge on a driver's license, for example. The problem is it can't be anything voting related, probably, because that would be an unconstitutional poll tax. So it's got to be on something that really isn't related to voting. By definition, it has to be that. Driver's license is just one potential area, but it could be, I suppose, anything. But that's something to consider, whether counties, particularly smaller counties, or counties of whatever size that don't have the tax base to do a once-in-a-decade, once-in-a-decade-and-a-half big expense. So I just flagged that for your convenience. There's no bill before you, obviously, but that's something. And another thing that I heard from a lot of county administrators over the last number of years has to do with election judges. I think there's some creative solutions out there. It's tough to recruit and retain election judges in some jurisdictions, probably all jurisdictions, tougher in some than in others. And they are the folks who really make the system work. They don't do this for their health. They do it really out of a sense of civic duty. And I think that's another issue just to flag for you when it comes to county auditor duties and local duties. Same with Next are the municipal clerk duties. Now, this mostly arises from a delegation of authority from the county to a municipality. Minneapolis is a good example. Minneapolis has its own kind of election administration system apart from Hennepin County. Obviously, there's some overlap there, but that's one example as well. And they have similar duties as the county auditors do. Just a little bit about voting on Election Day. I mentioned election judges, 30,000 of them, nearly 4,000 precincts. I mean, that's a lot of people, and that's a long day, let's face it. For those who do it in one shift, some jurisdictions have the luxury by virtue of effective recruiting that they can divide up the shifts. But if you're doing one shift, that's a long day. Just the voting period is 13 hours from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. But, of course, it's not just the voting period. You got to get there an hour or two early, stay an hour or two or more late if you're counting absentee ballots and other things. It's a long, long day. There's a minimum of four election judges. Obviously, there has to be a representative of at least one of the major political parties there, too. That typically comes into play when a voter needs assistance, and we want to make sure that that person isn't getting assistance that is slanted one way or another. Absentee balloting, obviously a big issue because last election cycle, the one that we just ended a couple months ago, the state moved forward with no excuses absentee voting. Some call it vote from home. It was a bipartisan piece of legislation, as you all know, and as we'll get to later with some of the statistics, I think it was a great success in terms of just the numbers. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that since it's a timely issue. Obviously, there are two main kinds. There's kind of the regular kind for all of us who are here, and then there's military and overseas voters, usually governed by UOCAVA, the federal statute. When it comes to regular absentee voting, obviously at the county level and sometimes municipal, that's where it's administered. For state elections, you can see absentee ballots have to be tracked in the database, of course. It's a 46-day period. That's what the legislature decided when we passed it in 2013. So for 46 days before the election, anyone can vote absentee without an excuse now. And this last point, I think, is key, and I'll get to why a little bit later. But in Minnesota, and this is not the case with all states, in Minnesota, there's a witness requirement. Now, that's waived in certain circumstances, but there, as you know, if you've ever tried it or know someone who's tried it, you have to have a witness sign that absentee ballot. So you can read for yourself some of the other procedures on regular absentee balloting. I guess what I want to flag in particular is this, that it's human nature to kind of wait towards the last minute, if not the actual last minute. And we have data about how many of those who voted absentee did so a week out from the election, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and so on. And not surprisingly, the biggest bump in the graph is those who do it in the final week. The only problem with that, though perfectly permissible and understandable, particularly for voters who maybe are undecided and want to wait till the last minute because they want to get more information and see candidate debates, it's perfectly fine. The only risk there is that if someone turns in an absentee ballot that is flawed for some reason, maybe they forgot to get a witness signature, it is sometimes too late to certainly get a ballot mailed back to them, a sort of second bite at the apple, and in some cases even too late to notify them realistically in the proper channels. So that's just something to flag for you as well. So as you can see here, 7 days before the election, and that was a change, by the way, that the legislature made a couple years ago. It used to be the Friday before. Now it's 7 days before. Absentee votes are considered final, and the processing can start. And as some of you know, that means in the roster that you see when you walk into your polling place, that person's name is marked AB so that people can't vote twice. Or some people might have forgotten. There was one high-profile case in Blue Earth County where there was a woman who just forgot that she voted absentee. There were some limitations there as well. I think she had dementia and had forgotten, and unfortunately there was not an AB designation at the polling place, and over time that issue settled, but that's one example of what can happen. But what's supposed to happen is that there's an AB designation so the person doesn't also vote in person. So just a brief word about absentee voting for military and overseas voters. It is, of course, mostly military, but overseas voters can include students, diplomats, business people, missionaries, all manner of people, Minnesotans living overseas, but mostly military, it's fair to say. There are special processes under UOCAVA in Minnesota that we have extended to folks who are covered. For example, I mean, there. I think it's on the next slide, but there's some. Oh no, here it is. There's some special procedures, and the one that usually comes up most is those in the military who are overseas, for example, don't have to have a witness for their absentee ballot. The rest of us who are stateside and who are civilians, we do need a witness if we want to vote absentee, but you don't if you're overseas in the military. Just a word about mail balloting. You may remember, for those of you who remember this, 2 years ago, the legislature also took, I think, a step forward in making mail balloting more widely available. There used to be a cap for townships outside of the metro area, a cap of, I think it was 400, could avail themselves, if they wanted to, of mail-only voting. We got rid of that cap, I say we, because I was there at the time. The legislature at the time got rid of the cap. So now outside of the metro area, townships of any size can do that. You can see the other parameters here. But that's been popular where it's been tried. It's up to the local community. One of the reasons is convenience, but another reason, of course, is cost. Polling places are expensive. They have to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. There are other compliance requirements that, especially for townships, and smaller units of government are sometimes difficult to comply with. So having that flexibility, I think, is a good thing. That's the direction that we've been moving in as a state for a while.
So, excuse me, Mr. Secretary, at this time, I'd just like to note that a quorum is present. I should have done that a while ago. Sorry.
No problem.
Break there.
Madam Chair and members, just a quick review of the 2014 election. You can see some of the facts and figures yourself, but it is interesting that we dipped in turnout. I think the apples-to-apples comparison, of course, is another non-presidential election. As you can see here, there was a dip, but not so much with absentee voters. There was a dip, but not a sort of pro rata dip, you might say, and I think that's due to the no-excuses absentee voting regime. In other words, we fell off by a third in terms of in-person voting, but not nearly by that proportion when it comes to absentee voting. But we did fall off. We're typically first, second, or third in the country. This time, I regret to say, we did not medal, you might say. We were sixth, didn't make the medal stand. So we're still at the top of the list. We were at about 50.2%. What's the next? Oh, okay. Yeah, about 50.2%, and we were sixth. And you can see here, it's probably not real easy to see on the screen here, but here's just a map, and our office can give all these color-coded maps to you as well about turnout by county general election. It was not uniform, but I think we have some work to do.
And, Mr. Secretary, is it fair to say that it looks like, and I don't know if I can read this correctly, but some of the counties that are more sparsely populated may have had higher turnout because they have mail balloting? Is that a fair characterization?
Madam Chair, I would say that is a legitimate conclusion to draw, that would have contributed to. I don't know that anyone can say that's the only reason, but I think where communities have decided that they're going mail only, turnout has typically been pretty good.
And I can't remember, is it that a county can decide on mail balloting or no? Actually, it's obviously a city or a township.
That's right, Madam Chair. It's the individual city or township.
Okay. And sorry, I'm not meaning to grill you here on mail balloting, but do you know roughly what percentage of townships or cities that are considered small for this definition utilize mail balloting?
Madam Chair, I don't know the percentage. I know the raw number of people. I know that at last count it was roughly 50,000 people. I'd have to check on that, but that was my current understanding of the number of people who did mail-only balloting.
So it's still a really, really small percentage of overall voters
it's
in Minnesota.
Small.
Thank you.
Just a word about no-excuse absentee voting, since that's a new innovation here. A big jump here in absentee voting. 55% increase as compared to 2010. I think the obvious conclusion is that that was because of the no-excuses absentee piece. I know my own dad used it. You know, he's disabled. He's 81. He doesn't drive anymore, and he was thrilled to be able to use it without excuse. And I think there are many more like him, whether they have a disability or they're just plain busy. And so the conclusion that I draw is that's what drove that spike in absentee voting. Just a couple of quick charts and tables here about voting patterns. Oh, yes, that's right. We do have the chart by week here. That's right. 2010 versus 2014. This is the ballots accepted absentee ballots by week. As you can see, not surprisingly, the one closest to the election in both years is the highest. And then if you go to 10, 12, and 14, 12, of course, being a presidential, really the same thing, not surprising, human nature. And not only human nature, but as I say, people genuinely probably want to hear all the candidates out, hear the debates, watch the ads, make up their decision, you know, late in the game.
You're optimistic if you think voters want to see the ads, I think, Mr. Secretary.
Well, I may be, Madam Chair. So just a quick rundown of the no-excuse absentee voting. The acceptance rate was high, 98.7%. There were 2,612 ballots rejected, ultimately rejected. Now, there were more than that were maybe rejected initially, but then that person was hopefully contacted, told that there was a defect of some kind in the ballot, and was able to, in essence, do it over. And some of those, as you can see, just decided to vote on Election Day, just the one time.
Mr. Secretary, that would be like the example you gave before. Someone forgot to have a witness. They maybe didn't sign the ballot. Other things.
Right. That's correct, Madam Chair. And this next pie chart I find really interesting because, as you can see, the two biggest categories adding up to 20%, or adding up to 60%, rather, 20 and 40, are witness related, which I suppose begs the question of whether we need to tinker with or revisit the whole witness requirement. You know, that's a decision for you, but it is interesting that of the reasons for rejection or defect, you know, 60% have to do with the witness, either no witness signature or some other witness-related error. Keep in mind that for overseas military, we waive the entire witness requirement. So that's just something to think about. Quickly, use of online tools. You remember that last session, the legislature passed not only online voter registration, but online absentee ballot applications as well. So here's the data for that. 16,000 updated, 12,000 new. And in terms of online absentee ballot applications, I thought this was amazing. 42,567 voters requested an absentee ballot online. I think that is in line with the prediction that many people at this table, I'm sure, made, which is just as people expect that online accessibility in other aspects of their life and in private sector dealings, they also have come to expect it and feel comfortable with it when it comes to the public sector and other duties. So that's all I had for the formal PowerPoint, members. I thought I'm happy, Madam Chair, to stand for any questions or comments or suggestions before I give a very brief overview on some just general concepts, policy concepts that we're thinking of this session.
Members, any questions for the new secretary? What has been the most surprising thing that you found in your first weeks in office here, Mr. Secretary? Is there a dramatic difference, for example, between the number of constituents who want to come and visit with you versus being a legislator?
Well, I would say, Madam Chair, the one thing to get used to is it's a different kind of issue portfolio. Obviously, when you're a legislator, you get comments on a whole range of issues. They may or may not be your committee assignments. They may or may not be your issues that you think you have expertise in, but it's a broad range, 100 issues or more, I suppose, across the spectrum. Obviously, it's a narrower portfolio of issues here in the office of Secretary of State. So that specialization, I suspect, is going to take some getting used to over time. But it's interesting. It really, the advantage is you can really focus. But so far, when I'm finding that I'm hearing from members of the public, whether it's a phone call or an email, obviously it's on a narrower range of issues. I guess that's the thing that strikes me as significant in the first 10 days. Madam Chair and members, and there's no PowerPoint here, but I just wanted to flag for you, and you'll have bills before you, obviously, as the session progresses, but I wanted to flag for you some of the priorities of this office in the legislative arena, and then there may be others that I don't mention here that we're still contemplating and coming online with, but I wanted to talk to you about some of the things that you might expect to hear from our office about. Thank you. The first one has to do with, I think, what we do as a state after what I think is the success of no excuses absentee voting. I think that was a big step forward, obviously a bipartisan step forward. Minnesotans seem to have really taken to it. They seem to really like the comfort and convenience of being able to vote from home, vote on their own terms for a period of 46 days before the election. And that's a good thing. I think that we ought to take it to the next step, which is true early voting. 32 other states have early voting, including every state that surrounds us. We are surrounded. North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin all have it. Stereotypically red states and stereotypically blue states have it. I think it's worked well in the states that have tried it. And the difference, of course, is this would be a system by which a voter could, under game day conditions, so to speak, could cast a ballot that is actually counted and processed that day, as opposed to an absentee ballot, which is placed in an envelope, held somewhere under lock and key, and not opened or processed in the first instance until a week before the election, and ultimately and finally not until election day or election night itself. There's another advantage here, and I suspect many of you will be hearing from a lot of county governments and other local government units, and that's the cost issue. I'm very happy that we passed No Excuses Absentee Voting. As I say, voters, I think, have taken to it, but it is more expensive, a lot more expensive. And I think you're going to hear from local election administrators that they would like some mechanism where they can get some relief from that. And I think early voting would do that. It would take off some of the pressure. And you can imagine there are a lot of little things. For example, postage both ways has to be paid by the government. Otherwise, it would be a poll tax. So postage both ways, there's a lot of time and energy and paperwork involved, absentee ballot boards and all the rest in absentee voting in general. So early voting would not replace or supplant No Excuses Absentee. It would be an overlay on top of it. And as I said, 32 states have already done this of varying characters and profiles and geographic regions, and I really hope that the legislature this year will consider that. You know, the legislature could, as it often does, write in all sorts of protections, guardrails, conditions, etc., and that's fine, but I think this is a natural next step. So early voting is one. Another one that...
Excuse me, Mr. Secretary.
No, I'll let him finish, please.
Senator Hall.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Secretary of State, welcome.
Thank you.
My question was, are there what are the negatives to the early voting? I mean, what are the possible abuses there? Do you know?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Hall. I would say this. I would couch it in terms of an advantage of absentee voting in general, whether with an excuse or not, versus an early vote. And that is, with an absentee ballot, I have to concede, a voter can claw that back within a week of the election. So let's say someone votes on day 45 before the election, and he or she then sees a news report, and they want to change their mind, basically. It is possible to kind of claw that ballot back. You can't do that when you have early voting. It's final. There's no changing your mind. So I fully concede that is one. For some voters, that might be a comparative disadvantage. That's why I say having the option of both, at least in my judgment, would be a good thing. But there's no question there are trade-offs, and that's one that occurs to me.
And Mr. Secretary, to follow up on that point, do you have a specific period of time that you have advocated for having an early voting period? Because as different bills have been batted around the legislature here the past years, we've discussed having the full 46 days or having a shorter period of time, and I'm just curious if you have a date of time prior to the election that you support early voting.
Madam Chair, I believe what we've the starting point in prior sessions, including I think your bill, Madam Chair, is roughly 2 weeks, if not actually 2 weeks beforehand. I think that is sort of the average of most states. It's certainly not the 46 days. I think that would be kind of difficult. But in most states, my understanding is it's a week or 10 days or 2 weeks for in-person sort of game day condition, true early voting, where the vote is actually processed that day. It's a couple of weeks or so, give or take.
And Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Secretary, again, what's your support for earlier primary? And pardon me if I got here a little late and you didn't talk about that.
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, and that was one of the next items on the list, was the June primary. I've been a supporter of June primary. Minnesota, as I said and as you all know, is at the top of the list of turnout in general elections. We're usually 1, 2, or 3. We were 6 this time, but that's still pretty good. Paradoxically, we've been at the bottom of the list the last couple of cycles because of the August placement of the primary. So I and many of you were involved a few years ago in changing it from our old September date to August. The problem with September, if you remember, was that it was so late that it was really shortchanging some of our overseas military, because a 2-month window was too short to count the ballots, certify the result, order the general election ballots, print the ballots, mail them to that person in a submarine in the Mediterranean for 6 weeks, and have them exercise their right to vote. That was unfair. and the Pentagon rightly said that states should move it, and we did. The question was how early. At the time, I supported June, but the compromise was August, and I think that's better than September from the standpoint of accessibility. It's not better than September from the standpoint of turnout. And Minnesotans, you know, who remember cold snaps like this week, really squeeze every last drop out of summer. And I think in August, Minnesotans do what Minnesotans do, which they're out having fun and getting that fun in before school starts. And so we saw a really low turnout this time. And this was a good test because there was a lot of there were two dramatic races in both parties. There was a dramatic, closely contested primary for governor on the Republican side and for state auditor on the DFL side. So I don't think any observer could say that the low turnout was due to boring election contests. Both parties had some action going on, I think it's fair to say. So I think that August primary is problematic. I think July would probably have mostly the same problems. June, while not perfect, is probably the next best solution. And even a June primary would put us about middle of the pack. The last I saw, it would put us, I think, 24th, so almost exactly in the middle of the pack. So it's still not considered an early primary, in my judgment, or objectively, I guess, compared to the other states. You know, it would take some doing. The one sensitivity that I have to it is I have heard from local election officials, county auditors and auditor treasurers, many of whom, particularly in greater Minnesota, wear many hats, including the property tax hat. And some are concerned that the February, March, April, May period is their busiest when it comes to property taxes. If we move the primary to June, it would also become a busy time for them in elections. So one way to cure that is an effective date that's out a couple election cycles or something like that. But that's really your purview. But since you asked, I do think it's important that we revisit the primary date. No date is perfect for anyone, but I do worry about the really low turnout, particularly with races of note in both major political parties. So that was one of the points I was going to talk about, Senator Hall. I'll just go to the next one, which is UOCAVA, which I mentioned in the PowerPoint presentation. There are a couple changes to UOCAVA to accommodate our folks in the military and others overseas. One, interestingly, has to do with extending the same protections to those who are called to National Guard duty for state responsibilities as opposed to federal. I think it's important that there be uniform treatment and that the higher federal treatment also be afforded to those folks as well. And so we can talk about that when there's a bill before you. But I think it's important that those folks who put on the uniform have that extra accommodation. They've certainly earned it, in my judgment. Then there are some issues as well. There will be kind of an admin or technical bill, you might say, comprised of a lot of smaller items that we've heard about. Everything from getting rid of the word cassette tape in one statute, which I think we can all agree on, to other more technical changes that will just speed up the operation of the election system. And then the final thing that I would mention of note here is I think that it's important to start the discussion about any potential redistricting reform. The middle of the decade is a good time to do it. We're far enough away from the last reapportionment and redistricting where anyone who was upset about it might be over it by now. And we're far enough from the 2020 or I guess 2021 map-making exercise that no one here would really make any decision based on their predictions about the 2020 legislative races. I guess what I'm saying is the closer you get to that end of the decade, the more likely it is that anybody is going to maybe hedge their bets on whether they're for a particular reform based on whether they think, even subconsciously, even if they don't voice this, on whether they think their political party might be the map makers after the 2020 election. And even the most astute political observer and pundit is not yet handicapping the 2020 House and Senate races. So I would say this is a good time to at least have the discussion. I would say go beyond that. There are some great bipartisan proposals out there that I think you'll hear about later. But I think that issue is a good one, even though it seems remote in time. I think that remoteness actually recommends a discussion rather than the other way, because we're equidistant from either ends. So those are just some things I wanted to flag for you. I know I didn't give a lot of detail. I'm happy to if you care to discuss it, but I just wanted to flag some issues and priorities for this office, and there may be more as the session goes on, but I just thank you for your time and attention. I'm happy to take any questions. The only thing I would say, Madam Chair, just to close out the presentation, is I really want to reiterate what I said at the beginning for those who came in a little bit later. I want those on the senior staff to be as open and as accessible to all of you and your staff as possible. So I urge you, drop by the State Office Building on the first floor. call me, call any of the other senior staff, either here or others. We want to be totally open and accessible to you, not only your comments, your concerns, your questions, but your constructive criticisms as well. So please take us and take me in particular up on that offer. I really do welcome it now in this hearing or any time throughout the session. So,
thank you, Mr. Secretary. Likewise, we, I think, on this committee feel, I feel especially happy that you're in this role and look forward to working with you. You've always been very easy to work with in your role as a legislator when you were the chair of the committee in the House, and I certainly appreciate that openness and look forward to a productive session.
Thank you.
And also thank you, Ms. Kainer-Roth and Ms. Stroller, for being here today, and we look forward to working with you guys as well. If there are no other questions, then, Senator Hayden moves the minutes from the Tuesday, January 13th hearing. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion passes. So with that, the committee is adjourned.
Yeah, she has to leave. She's going to end up leaving that joint.